investors considering the risk-free rate of return, you have to take that into consideration too. The demands of your investors sometimes going to be the tail that wags the dog, unfortunately. And you have to take that in consideration and bake it into your projections on the types of deals you're going to do.
Do you love your job, but want other investment options than your company's 401k and trying to pick stocks? If so, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, you will get actionable information for your passive real estate investment journey. Welcome back to another episode of Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. Here's your host, Justin Dixon.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast. I am your host, Justin Dixon. And today on the podcast, we've got Matt Druin. Matt lives up in Rochester, New York, which is actually where he primarily focuses a lot of his real estate investing focus. Matt started his journey kind of forced into it, if you will. Said he had to the end of the year to get out of the house and find his own place to live. So he decided to, instead of renting a place, he decided to buy a 4-unit apartment complex so he could live rent free. So we talk about his journey from being a bank teller to a real estate investor and a realtor, acquiring his first 76 units, getting to financial freedom by the age of 33, and then transitioning from the smaller 2 to 6 unit apartment complexes into office storage, offices storage, and larger multis. Very interesting episode with Matt. So let's get Matt on the pod. Matt, man, hey, welcome to the podcast. Happy to have you on.
Oh, thanks for having me, Justin. It is an honor.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the time. So let's just kind of jump right in. Maybe give a quick overview of who you are, where you are, and then we can kind of unpack some stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I had been a real estate professional for 17 years, but I got into the business by accident. It started in 2006. I went to a state school, a SUNY school, Geneseo, and I thought that I was going to be like a stock trading, Gordon Gekko type, cigar chomping, rapacious capitalist and that sort of thing. And I graduated in 2006, B student with a liberal arts degree from a state school. And I thought I was going to conquer the world. And in 2006, I don't know if your listeners have been through that, but if you were looking for a job in 2006, when you had a liberal arts degree with no experience, it was a tough go. We were at the peak of the economy. I'd had interview after interview after interview. I had so many applications I put out there with no responses. And so finally, the best job I could find was as a part-time bank teller at Chase Bank in my old hometown. It was a suburb of Rochester, New York. And I hated the job. It just absolutely sucked. To put on top of it being standing in one place all day, I also had, you know, my colleagues from school. I lived in a sort of affluent suburb. My family moved out of the city of Rochester to put us in a better school district. They used every single penny they had to buy their house there. So we were house poor. We lived on sort of the working class area of the area. So I had this sort of inferiority complex. And I was graduating from a state school, and my friends with fancy degrees from like Northwestern and Yale were coming in and depositing their first paychecks from their jobs. And I was just like,
that's got to be awkward and awful at the same time, where you're like, you know how much you're making. And they're like, here, can you put this in my bank account? And you're just seeing that grow and grow and grow.
Yeah. So it kind of sucked on all fronts, right? So I remember complaining about this job to my dad all the time. He went full-time as a realtor, and he didn't start off that way. He was a general laborer for Genesee Brewery. And he was like, listen, Matt, if you want to get your real estate license, I will show you the ropes. I'm not going to give you any deals. I'm not going to feed you any business. You're going to have to go out and grow your own book of business. Anything as an alternative to what I was doing, I was willing to eat a poop sandwich as an alternative to working for Chase Bank. So I took the opportunity and went in. It was definitely a rough go trying to build a business as a realtor. I looked young, I was inexperienced, but I made a go of it. And I saved up about $16,000 in rent check. I mean, not in rent checks, in commission checks. And my dad gave me the boot out of the house. He was like, you got till the end of the year to move out of the house. So you can either get an apartment with your friends or buy a multifamily house and live in one of the units and rent out the rest. And I liked the idea of not paying rent because I wasn't paying rent to my good old dad. So
first landlords.
Yeah. So when I closed on that property, the really major aha moment was I closed in the middle of the month, 2 weeks went by, and I magically had $1,800 in rent checks sitting in my mailbox. All right.
Yeah.
Now, if you knew what type of real estate I sold at that point in time, we have these ABC streets in the city of Rochester, Avenue A, Avenue B. This is not the newer alphabet city. I mean, this was tough properties, $40,000 deals. It took me a lot of work to earn $1,800 in commission checks.
Right.
So I was like, damn, this is almost like criminal. 2 weeks went by, I earned $1,800 and I had like, there's work involved with it, but it's passive-ish income. So that's really where I got bit by the bug. And I just started scaling from there and utilizing techniques that I didn't really even know existed. I was just kind of like hammerheading my way through the whole thing. And you know, fast forward, I acquired up to 76 doors over a 13-year period, a smaller multifamily. And I was able to claim my financial freedom or financial independence at the age of 33. I'm 39 now. My major painful process of reinventing myself came when I woke up in the morning and I didn't have to set an alarm clock. And my wife, my number one partner, was at work. She was a teacher. And that dream of backpacking through Italy for 2 months, I wasn't going to do it on my own. So I was like, all right, well, I knew I wanted to do big deals from the get-go. And so now is my time. So my second sort of aha moment was when I came across $1 million commercial deal. I didn't have the money to take it down, but I knew that this was the ticket to kind of launching myself into the big league, so to speak. I had so many limiting beliefs and glass ceilings above my head. I took that one deal down and I had to raise $300,000 in capital. It was my first time raising capital. And that one deal alone, when I refinanced it and implemented the value add strategy, replaced my wife's income with that one deal.
Wow.
And I never looked back. So here I am today.
That's awesome. So there's a lot to unpack there. And I guess you kind of benefited, I guess, from kind of living in a tough love house because you weren't in a situation where you could just kind of rest easily, right? I think some people, they grow up and they get taken care of or they find a cushy job and all that fun stuff. And it's easy. Your life sounds like it wasn't bad in the sense that like it was, you grew up in a really poor area or whatever, but like you had like parents that were like, no, you got to figure this out. Like, we're not going to handhold you through this whole process. Your dad's saying he's not going to give you any deals or share any of that stuff. That's pretty awesome. So I guess from a mindset perspective, because I think mindset's like a very important thing. Like my mindset shifted 5 years ago when we started investing in real estate and kind of reading books and kind of just thinking like, oh, wow, there's actually something else out there other than the stock market and a 401k and all that fun stuff. But like, how did your mindset kind of shift? Or was it always kind of in this like entrepreneurial spirited, like I'm going to figure my own thing out? It sounds like you kind of were like, I'm going to go the stockbroker route and be the Gordon Gekko, which is starting out as a W-2 employee and kind of working your way up. But like, how did that shift your mindset of like, no, I got to figure this out and then just do it?
Having my back against the wall has always been where I've been in the best position of strength. And that's just me personally. Some people don't feel like, don't want to have their back up against the wall. But when you have to do something because your life depends upon it, now I'm not talking about life or death here, but when the stakes are high and the pressure is high and you have all of these things that are uncomfortable, is kind of where my major moments of growth have been. So this whole thing, I'm a completely different individual right now than I was when I was a kid. I was a quiet daydreamer. I was very timid and I didn't want to take risks on anything because risks to me were scary. You know, Tony Robbins talks about getting pulled through instead of trying to push through. That's kind of how I've been able to grow. Because you know, everybody knows, like if there's a car driving down the street that's got a rope on the end of it and you grab a hold of that rope, that car is going to drag you with it. But try getting a car going from a dead stop. It's just a different type of animus to the whole thing. So I think that's kind of what I attribute that mindset shift and shifts to, because it continues to shift.
Yeah, that's the beauty of like the real estate game is like once you learn one thing, you realize like, oh, wow, there's like a bunch of other things. And like I've experienced myself where it's like it's hard to focus on one thing where it's like, because you hear about other people doing amazing things in Airbnb or these all these other cool parts of real estate. So I'm curious to learn a little bit more about that first multifamily deal. Obviously, you had to figure it out, but how big was it? Like, did you have tenants already? Like, how did you find them? I'm very curious about that like house hacking strategy. You probably did it before the word was even invented, but it's a very popular strategy, especially amongst like early investors or younger folks, because they have maybe the interest in living in a small multi and having roommates or people living in apartments right next to you. So let's talk about that first, and then we'll dig into some of the stuff you're doing more recently.
Yeah, so it wasn't too scary for me because, I mean, all four units were occupied. There was a tenant that's lease was rolling off in the springtime, summertime, something like that. I don't remember. But the reason why I chose that unit is because it had access to the attic, right? Mm. This was 4 one-bedroom apartments. I wanted to not pay anything, not mortgage, taxes, insurance, repairs, maintenance. I want to have everything covered.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, well, I'll move up to the attic, which this attic was not very comfortable. I mean, I had to run the air conditioning probably 80% of the year.
Right.
But I got a roommate. with a situation and I painted up the attic. It was the old servants' quarters in the house. And so I'd say call it a stabilized value add deal.
Okay. So you don't have to do a lot of like work to the other units. They were already occupied and they were like, for all intent and purposes, ready to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And I had no idea about like, oh, the rents were below market and that sort of thing. All I was looking at was what the current rents were on the property. Yeah. I was like, okay, I just did basic, like sort of just rudimentary math. And I was like, okay, I can make this work and it works to fit my goals. You know, fast forward, I still own that property to this day, but rents were $650 a month on those one bedrooms. And I did some improvements, like cosmetic improvements over the years, but now those apartments are renting for about $1,000 a month. But I mean, I learned how to do that in terms of increasing value through watching other people do it and utilizing increasing the value. You refinance it, you pull some cash out, use it for your next deal.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some of the next strategies. And I'm curious kind of about going from that first deal to the next one, because obviously you were a bank teller, right? So they weren't making a ton of money and probably still don't at this point. But before we dig into this next deal, I want to kind of take a quick sponsor break. So we will be right back.
Whether you're trying to hire a full-time employee or a contractor to fill a gap, Hire Tomorrow can help. Hire Tomorrow is a boutique recruitment firm that has successfully filled sales and marketing, human resources, and technology positions with companies ranging from startups to Fortune 500. If you're struggling to find the right talent, check out HireTomorrow.com or reach out to recruiting@HireTomorrow.com to see how they can help.
All right, we are back on the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast with Matt. Before the break, we kind of talked a little bit about kind of your entry into the real estate world, kind of being kicked into it essentially. And then kind of the first deal that you took down is that kind of house hacking deal. So how did you go from that first one? And then you're obviously, it sounds like you were a realtor at that point. So commission only, I'm guessing. So you had to be selling deals in your real estate game to then fund your investments. So kind of walk us through kind of the next few years of evolution and getting up to that 76, I think you said 76 units to kind of hit that financial freedom. So let's kind of walk through some of that stuff.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the big problem people have with growth is they buy their first investment property and they blow out all their cash.
Yep.
That $16,000 I put down in this owner-occupied four-family was everything I had, but I knew I wanted to grow. So the next deal was actually a few doors down from it. It was probably the worst house on the street. It was another four-family. And my dad kept pestering me every time he came over for beer and pizza to hang out with me. He was like, did you call on that property yet? It looks like they're going to need to sell that thing pretty soon because it's like the roof is shot. There's trees overhang. The trees look like they're going to crush the house pretty soon. There's like broken down cars behind the house. So basically my dad encouraged me, right? He pestered me. And so that nagging of like, okay, I don't want my dad to ask me this question anymore. So I just made it a point to get in touch with the owner. Fast forward, I got the property under contract for $80,000. The first one I bought was $165,000. Okay. So I bought this one for $80,000. And this was in a great neighborhood, by the way. You could not get financing in this property. The roof was shot. I mean, everything. The porch was falling apart. So I got under contract and I was like, Dad, I did what you said, like offer him $80,000 cash and close in 4 weeks. What do I do now? I don't have $80,000
right.
in cash.
Who has the money?
Yeah. So the mortgage company that we had a relationship with that we referred a lot of our clients to, unbeknownst to me, did hard money lending. Mm. The principal of the company, Phil Nothnagel, basically I presented the deal with them, my numbers, and kind of like, oh, this is what's going to be worth afterwards. And I can take it to a bank and take your loan out in less than 12 months. Right. So I got the acquisition finance, the $80,000 plus $60,000 worth of repairs. And also the payments on the mortgage were deferred for 12 months.
Oh, wow.
So it bought me a lot of runway to have like some margins of error because I made a ton of mistakes in the process. But that was my major aha moment. It's like you can grow a real estate empire with none of your own money if you know how to raise capital and put deals together,
yeah,
creative deals sometimes. And so that first deal, the four family, was that $16,000 of my seed fund to start the whole thing. And I haven't put another dime into our deals thus far.
So talk more about that because my wife and I, our first deal was a duplex. And I was always nervous about single family just because one tenant, one occupancy, if that person leaves, I'm on the hook for the whole mortgage, right? So obviously you had a similar mindset, I'm assuming, because going into a four unit, you knew you could cover at least the mortgage, assuming you had a few tenants in there. So you buy this next one on financing through the mortgage lender. What time period is? Because obviously you started in 06, 07, 08, 09 were not great from a housing market perspective. So is this in that time frame?
So it was in 2008 is when I closed on this property. Yeah. And it took me a year to turn it around. I was a 20 something year old kid trying to work with contractors, trying to be the boss, being the guys on HGTV that manage these flips. And I got taken advantage of like left, right, and center. But I managed to get through it. I learned a lot in the process, but I was able to increase the value on that property sufficient to where I was able to take it to a community bank and get it refinanced and take the hard money out. And so I was like, okay, well, let's do this at scale.
Yeah.
So that's what I ended up doing since then.
Got it. Where are you getting for the next kind of 3, 4, 5 deals? Like, where's the capital coming from? Because it sounds like you just said, like, I don't really use any of my own money to fund some of these deals. So are you raising it from investors, or how are you getting that capital?
So the first 76 doors was utilizing the Burr strategy and hard money.
Okay.
All right. So established relationships with some private money lenders that they weren't as hard as some of the hard money you see out there, like between 7% and 9% interest I was paying them. Sometimes it was interest deferred. And the deals were small enough in terms of being sub 500,000 that I could find private money lenders that were comfortable putting a first lien position mortgage on it.
Yeah.
The major shift was when I went to go after this $1 million deal, and that was just too much. There wasn't a lot of these private money lenders that had that type of dry powder to do that. So I was like, okay, well, I've heard of raising capital for like in terms of equity to buy deals. So maybe that's a thing. And that's what I did on that deal. And then that's how I've structured all of my deals since then as we've grown.
Got it. So the 76 doors that you've purchased, have they all been the Burr method where you're buying them, you're renovating, refinancing, and all that fun stuff? So you're essentially just kind of taking that initial capital, that hard money lender, putting it into a deal, using that to also fix it. Obviously, you're increasing the value of that property, take it to a bank saying, cool, it's worth more. I'm going to pull out all that cash. So you have that cash and maybe a little bit more left over. And then you just kind of rinse and repeat that process.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Since then, I've just kind of bolted that same strategy, but on larger commercial deals. So we're essentially doing, and a lot of other capital raisers that are in the larger multifamily space, I mean, they're essentially doing commercial burring. You know, they'll buy a 200 unit for $20 million and then they'll fix it up and push the value to $30 million. And, you know, it's really the same concept. It's just at a different order of magnitude.
Got it. And so how many of the 76 units, I guess, do you still own all of them, or have you kind of sold some off and then repositioned that capital?
So I've kind of developed a barometer for our holdings. So return on equity is basically the barometer. And I want to be consistently achieving about 11% return on equity with all of my holdings. Now, all the properties aren't always going to meet that. But if there's one that's appreciated a lot, where I paid a lot of debt down and the return on equity drops on properties over years. You pay debt down, hopefully the property appreciates and your cash flow doesn't grow commensurate with your equity position. Right. So when properties go below 11% significantly, consistently, I make the decision to either refinance it and pull cash out again, or I'll sell the property. So there was a two family as part of that portfolio I just sold recently. The property I owed $130,000 on it. Similar properties were trading for about $360,000. That property was cash flowing about $4,000 a year. So I couldn't go and strap more debt on it. And I was like, if I was going to do that, then I might not even meet my debt service coverage ratio covenant with my bank. So it was a very clear decision for me to sell that property. Now, how I repositioned that capital was most people say, oh, do a 1031 exchange. Well, I didn't want to do that because I've seen what it's done to clients, especially in a really, really tight market that we're in right now, where the bid-ask spreads between what sellers are expecting and what buyers need to pay considering current interest rates. I just didn't want to have that gun against my head. So I just basically just put the cash in my balance sheet. We'll do the taxes for 2023 and see how it shakes out from what other net loss carry forwards I can do to wash out that capital gain. And then maybe do a cost segregation analysis in one of my larger assets to wash that out even further. Maybe I won't have to pay any capital gains on it.
Yeah, I think the 1031 is a great like tool to use, but it is a time constrained tool, right? You have to find a deal in a certain amount of time and then place that money. And so there is a ticking time bomb, so to speak, where you've got to kind of put that money somewhere. So you don't want to put it in someplace bad, right? You want to make sure it's a good investment. But yeah, it's unless you have a deal kind of lined up, which you ideally would, that way you can just kind of flip it over and make it a lot easier. So I'm curious about the deal sizes, right? Because a lot of people that I talk to that, including myself, that started out in smaller multis, 2, 4, 5, whatever units, they buy a few of the smaller deals. They go maybe to the 20 or 30 units, and then they buy one or two of those. And like, no. With the ultimate goal of getting to that syndicator, like 100 plus unit apartment complex. And it sounds like you've been very successful in this smaller multi-space, which I think is really fascinating because you have built a 76 unit portfolio over a number of deals. So I'm curious about how many deals are there in that? Are they all 2 to 4 unit properties? And then how do you manage it all? It's easy managing. I say easy. It's relatively easy managing one 76 unit property versus 10 7 unit properties.
Yeah, that's a great question. When I was in growth mode, my plan was to fire myself from the operations. I had the economies of scale to hire somebody in-house to manage that portfolio. So I grew to that level. I had a kind of a cobbled together management structure where I was doing the leasing and I was doing the rent collection. And then I was having like a maintenance company do the maintenance and the turns and all that. But yeah, I mean, that was the major moment where I was able to actually put gasoline on my fire and start going into the larger deal space. Was when I was able to bring out a partner to create a management company to manage like my stuff so that I could concentrate 100% of my focus on growing the company, growing a relationship with our potential investment partners, as well as working on deal flow as well for our business, which are the two bottlenecks to any investor's growth is deal flow and capital.
Yeah. And so are you looking at all these deals in Rochester area, like in that neck of the woods? Like, are you trying to keep it in your backyard?
I have a competitive advantage here. I mean, I know every street, I know every neighborhood, I know all the major players in the market. And I think that's non-replicatable, unique value proposition is when you have rich understanding of your market.
Yeah.
So I've definitely leaned on that heavily. Would I be opposed to going outside of our market? Absolutely not. I mean, we're sort of a good blend between equity and cash flow in our market. Typically, the deals I'm buying are usually around between 8.5% stabilized cap rate. I mean, sometimes I get like, damn, 4% cap rate markets seem very, very attractive to me sometimes. If you can push a rents in a market that have consistently 7% rent appreciation over a 20-year period, so you have like a really, really good data for a stable market, and you're able to buy at a 4% cap rate. And if you increase the NOI $100,000 over 5 years, you create $2.5 million worth of value.
Right.
So I've definitely considered it. I haven't made the jump yet, but I'm not taking it off the table.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you said you're 39, right? So I'm sure you're going to be doing this for a little bit longer. So let's talk about that transition to the bigger stuff, right? I guess before you do that, what's the biggest deal you did unit size wise in that first 76?
The biggest one in that 76 was a 6-family.
Okay.
In terms of like one particular property. So it's all small multifamily.
Yeah. So you're doing a bunch of different deals, right? To get to that 76. Mm-hmm. So when did you make that transition to the larger deal? And it sounds like that first one was $1 million. So how big was that? And then let's talk about kind of how you raised that money, because it sounds like you've kind of used a different capital raising strategy on the first handful of deals. And now you're using the kind of traditional, if you will, strategy. So let's walk through that one.
Yeah. So that one was about a 16,000 square foot office building. It was all smaller offices. So small businesses. It was 100% occupied at the time that I bought it. I had a really strong rental history. The owner that I bought it from about 20 years and always had it at 100% occupancy. So one of the things that signaled to me is that when something's at 100% occupancy, then your rents are below market. Right. Yep. And also I looked at the expenses on the property. I was familiar with properties that it was an older property, really, really charming, like brick building with like slate Dutch colonial style roof in the front of the building. But the expenses were really high on the property as well. So I knew I had to push rents because they were clearly below market. And then also normalized expenses. Utility bills were high. The management company that had it under management had a part-time, like we're talking about 20 hours a week, part-time maintenance person allocated to this property.
Oh, geez. Okay.
And so I'm like, that's not right. Right. So that was definitely an expense that I was able to shave off. But I had a 5-year business plan. So I raised the $300,000. At this point in time, this was in 2017, interest rates were still low. So I offered out a fixed rate of return of 7% distributed monthly to the original investors in this deal. And I was oversubscribed. So fast forward to now, that's a completely different picture when you can get 5% on an FDIC insured money market account. But yeah, so I was able to keep 100% of the equity. They were happy with getting the mailbox money. I was able to increase the value from $1 million to $1.6 million over a 2-year period. So then I was able to have the equity there to refinance, pay them back the $300,000. And then they were investors. Those people, original ones, have been investors ever since on every single one of my deals.
Interesting. So instead of offering some type of a like true syndication where there's a pref or and there's pref return and then you've got an equity split and all the fun stuff, you're like, no, I'm going to keep all the equity. You just get a fixed rate of return. And then you are able to then essentially buy them out of their position once you are able to refinance and do a cash out, right? Like, so they're not even in the deal anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that every deal is different and then every market's different too. I mean, I think that real estate operators have to be familiar with what's going on in the capital markets outside of real estate as well.
Yeah.
I recognized that the bond market was paying really, really abysmally low coupon rates or yields. People were starving for yields. So 7% was better than a sharp stick in the eye, which is actually the words that one of my investors told me when I originally pitched in the deal, better than a sharp stick in the eye. So I think that now, fast forwarding, I think that investors considering the risk-free rate of return, you have to take that into consideration too. The demands of your investors, that's sometimes going to be the tail that wags the dog, unfortunately. And you have to take that in consideration and bake it into your projections on the types of deals you're going to do. But yeah, I mean, we've done straight up just fixed income deals. We've done equity partnerships. We've never done a full loan syndication. I only buy probably one deal a year that's larger. And I like to push the envelope because I'm like, if I can do $1 million deal, I can do a $2 million deal. If I can do a $2 million deal, I can do a $4 million deal.
Right.
And I've just been able to keep going back to the same well of investors and expanding that network of investment partners. And I've never had to go above the 25 investor mark there. So I've been able to kind of keep it as a more of like a joint venture. They're some kind of partner that is on the operating agreement. They have a membership interest. And then the operating agreement is customized what we set out to in terms of the offering. So that's kind of how we've done it since then.
Got it. So office space is kind of an interesting kind of topic just in general right now, given where we are and we're recording this in mid-August 2023. So remote, hybrid, work from home, all that fun stuff like is very kind of top of mind. I don't know what kind of office building that is, if it is true like office or if there's like medical offices or whatever, but like, are you still investing in office space or was that your one and only kind of commercial office real estate?
No, I own more office. I'm sort of contrarian. When there's something that comes out there that's the new hotness, whether it's STR or MTR or self-storage or whatever is out there, I kind of like to look at other things. But everything is managing risks. So this particular office building was, it's a lot of smaller office users. There's about 16 office tenants that are there. So we have users that are anywhere between 100 square foot singular office to maybe a 3,000 square foot office that has 15 employees that work out of it.
Yeah.
So there wasn't this major exposure to mom and pop companies, sometimes solopreneurs. So we're not talking about huge exposures where you have 20,000 square foot office floor plates. That type of stuff I wouldn't touch right now. But fast forward, I mean, we just closed on a 50,000 square foot high rise office building. And it was such a great deal because the entire investment community post COVID redlined office completely out. So we got a fantastic deal on a property that was occupied by government tenants with super long-term leases on a building that had no deferred maintenance either. So we were able to buy this thing at a 9% cap rate and we bought it based upon in-place occupancy. So this thing was 90% occupied and we were able to get the 10% for free. So whatever we lease up out of that 10% goes 100% of it goes straight to the net operating income.
Right.
So this is where you can really explode asset value through that, but doing it in a way that's heeding risk in the process.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like the bigger, newer office spaces are the ones that have maybe a little bit more risk in the kind of office space environment. I live in Austin and there's buildings being built left and right that are not occupied, right? They're still vacant, which is kind of weird to see. And so I guess after that 16,000 square feet deal you bought, that was your kind of first bigger opportunity. So where are you now from like a total assets under management and what's the mix of office and kind of residential slash multifamily?
So in terms of assets under management, we're about $15 million in assets under management, about $2 million a year in gross rents. So we're not huge. I mean, we're a pretty small operator in the grand scheme of things, especially if you compare us to operators in Austin, Texas, for instance. But I think that in terms of our asset allocation, real estate wise, we're probably about 70 to 80% residential and the rest of it is some type of commercial use. So whether it's retail, office, industrial, those types of things. So I've actually liked the more of the commercial use space. I feel like we have more of a partnership with our tenants.
Yeah.
The residential we own is typically in higher income areas. And these tenants, they basically, they use us for a couple of years and then they buy a house. but nothing really gave me a greater thrill than like buying a mixed use building that has the residential income coming on it and being able to like change the complexion of a corner along a major corridor by reprogramming the retail space. So that's where I kind of like, there's a lot of creativity that goes into the commercial space there, but you know, there's different moving parts involved with it. And I think that if you're interested in doing the commercial route, not just multifamily, consider buying a mixed use building because you're hedging your risks that way.
I mean, I've always been curious about the mixed use space because it kind of gives you the best of both worlds, assuming that you can occupy all the facets of the deal. But like, how does it work from more of a unit mix and a funding and all that stuff? Because obviously part of it is multifamily, part of it is commercial. Like there's some differences there. I'm just kind of curious, and we don't need to get too deep in the weeds, but it's kind of curious how you kind of underwrite that from like, you've got multifamily, you've got commercial tenants and all that.
So the underwriting part is, it's very difficult if you have vacant commercial space, because it's like typically most of the mixed use that I've bought, we've had occupancy of the commercial spaces. Maybe they've been below market rent. Great resource to finding, hey, is it below market rent? Is asking a broker, what's trading for in this area and where it's actually moving, not what they're asking for, but where these deals actually moving. Myself, I mean, I have a subscription to CoStar, so I'm able to pull a lot of data out of there, but I still ask brokers because with any data system, it's like it's garbage in, garbage out.
Yeah, it's always lagging, right? You're always getting historicals. It's not like future looking or like, where's it going? It's
Yeah. And then on the mixed use side of things, I mean, a lot of people and developers make the mistake of thinking like, I have prime storefront commercial space. I need to extract as much out of that as possible because this is pure gold. I think that's kind of the wrong approach to it. I think that you can add a lot more value to the residential, which is usually a bigger component of the whole stacking plan, than by programming just rocking commercial tenants that are going to bring street level vitality to a neighborhood.
Right.
And that rent may not be where you want it to be in terms of renting it to a national tenant, but you're going to be able to get a lot more value out of the rest of the deal by doing that. So for instance, one deal we did, it was, I put nail salon that was in one of the spaces. It's a creepy nail salon. I think they did human trafficking through there and stuff like that. I booted them out and I put in a crumpet shop. Like a crumpet is like basically, I can't even explain it. Just Google it to your listeners.
Tea and crumpets, right? It's like a little like a cake thing. Yeah.
But you know, super unique concept for the area to kind of bring that hipster vibe in there, you know, something as obscure as a crumpet, right? And then I put in a vintage clothing shop. I booted out Renaissance, which was in one of the spaces. I got a vintage clothing kind of haberdashery type of place. And the girl that operates this business has a lot of community events there. She does bicycle socials. She keeps the place out front pristine and looking great, which our residential tenants appreciate a lot.
Yeah, you obviously, that's the curb appeal, right? If you have cool like tenants in your commercial space that are taking care of the property and have appreciation of their own space, then the people above them and the tenants that are walking to their residential stuff are going to appreciate that space even more. So that's interesting. I'm curious about where you think we are in the economic cycle, right? In the sense that you're exposed to Rochester, and that's where you focus your kind of investing focus, but you're spread across a few different asset classes, which is makes sense. So again, mid-August 2023, interest rates are still high. Are they going to keep raising? Where do you think, and are you still a buyer in this market? Like, are you still actively looking for deals?
Yeah, I'm still looking for deals. I mean, I just got back from my desk underwriting a 300 unit plus multifamily deal. So we're still out there. We're still making offers. The major component that you have to take into consideration is your annual debt service. It's different. Yeah. And that really doesn't change things. It just changes what you can pay, right, for a place. Or if you're like, oh, okay, well, if you want that number, then are you willing to hold some paper at a lower rate at 4%? All right. So we've been making offers like that. I think that you have to maintain being active in a space. If you kind of go into a cave someplace and then come out 2 years later, you've missed so much. You've missed so much relationship building in the process that you're going to be miles behind your peers. So I think it's important to always be active in your space. And in terms of projections or predictions, I mean, I think that inflation numbers are definitely showing that the Fed's probably going to pulling back on rate increases. And I think what's going to end up happening is rates are going to start to go down as inflation goes down. I think that there's going to be a lot of places, especially companies are going to have to be working off inventory. I think that the recession we're going to see is not going to be kind of ubiquitous across the entire demographic spectrum. I think that we're going to have a white collar recession because a lot of the layoffs and stress you see in the economy are tech related and that type of thing. So it's going to be interesting to see. I think in the commercial space, there's definitely going to be deals. Residential, if you're small, single through four family, once interest rates drop considerably, all those buyers who are standing on the sideline are going to rush back into the market. All right. Yeah. I can afford to pay more. And so you're going to see those buyers rush back in because people don't really talk about it, but every decrease in interest in terms of points increases a buyer's affordability by 10%. So that can be definitely a factor. But I think that the commercial space there, I think there's a lot of people that are just been exhausted. There's a lot of people that have overpaid for stuff. So I think there's going to be some really great opportunities for us to expand in the contraction.
Yeah, I think there's some pain in the commercial space right now in the multifamily, which is the area that I know best or am most kind of involved in, because a lot of multifamily value add is variable rate debt, right? And if you bought it 2 years ago, you probably weren't anticipating, nobody was anticipating rates going where they are and as fast as they got there. So you're holding on to an asset that you may have overpaid for, you may have undercapitalized, and now your debt service has gone up by 50%. There's some interesting times ahead. I think being a good operator, and I'm curious, I know we've been talking for a while, so we'll wrap here in a second, but I'm curious about kind of the asset management side, because if you bought a deal in 2019, 2020, 2021, and you sold it in early 2022 or something, you could make a lot of money without really being good at your job. The economy and interest rates and cap rates compressing and all that fun stuff kind of papered over to the cracks of a lot of bad deals or bad operators, I guess. But what is your area of focus, I guess, from like a pure asset management perspective? Because that is where the rubber meets the road on these deals now, especially when we are in an uncertain environment. So you've got exposure across small multis, larger multis, office, mixed use. So how are you managing the assets to make sure that you're getting the returns that you need for yourself? And obviously you've got some investors now and all that.
Yeah. So the asset management, I spend about an hour on that each week. So I meet with my partner who runs the management company, and we talk about kind of high level operations and areas where he needs support or input. And I feel like the core value is retention, retention, retention. Bad retention equals property makes no money. So retention is driven by service. So I want to make sure that maintenance is on point, that we're proactively addressing things, that our residents are happy when they put a service request into our system, responded to within 48 hours. And I do look at the numbers every month in terms of the income expense statements and true it up against what the budget looks like. And so I think that asset management, yeah, as you said, nobody talks about it, but it's the most important thing, because if you don't have good operation, I don't care what your projections are, you're not going to meet them.
Yeah. I mean, all these deals are run by spreadsheets, right? So you can make any deal look amazing by changing a few numbers, but the rubber meets the road when you actually get that thing under contract and you take over the property and it's like, okay, now we've got to operate this thing. So we'll kind of transition here to the end. I'm curious kind of for the listeners that maybe they're just kind of dipping their toes in the water of real estate investing, whether they want to be active like you are, or they want to be more passive and they have a really good job or whatever, and they make money, but they just want to have access to other investment options. Like, what do you think are some good tips to kind of get people moving down the right path? Obviously, they're listening to a podcast about real estate investing, so they're already kind of starting that process. Like, how do you think it's a good next step to kind of get themselves educated and learn more about the space before they go ahead and invest passively, jump in with both feet actively?
Yeah, I think it's a good educational process. I mean, I think that podcasts can only go so far. I really think you need to get out there consistently and get belly to belly with people that are active in the space, period. That's what helps you raise your thermostat and raise the bar for yourself. So many investors do, like 99% of them that think they want to do it, never end up doing it. And there are people that I see, they've been seeing consistently at a cocktail party every 15 years that are always telling me that really to get into it. So surrounding yourself with those people that are active in it, definitely builds your confidence level. And then figuring out, I'm going to be honest with you, like there's people out there that are active, can help you educate yourself, but also real estate operators are always broke. Okay. And I'm so jealous of our investors because like they didn't put any of the work in to find the deals. They didn't put any of the work in to manage the business plan, the deals, to figure out, to raise the capital, put the debt in place and all the stuff that goes into it. And all they do is they just get a K-1 at the beginning of the year and they get their distribution checks. I'm jealous of that. That's the level I want to be at some point in time. So don't be afraid to be open to the idea of also passively investing in something, because I know that people with podcasts, that's how they got started in doing kind of leapfrogging into the larger deal space, is through being a limited partner on a deal. So I think that's the next step there, is just surrounding yourself with people that are actively doing it. And then that's going to help raise the bar for you.
Yeah, I think it's super important to obviously passive invest in deals. The first two large multifamily deals that we invested in were passive because we wanted to learn the space, and two, we actually learned about this whole self-directed IRA thing that you can like pump into and use that, which is super interesting. So awesome. Well, Matt, it's been a lot of fun. Let's kind of transition to the final three questions that I ask every guest. And I'm very curious about the last one because you already mentioned a little bit about it earlier and I didn't want to dig into it, but we may hear in this last section. So, all right, first question is, what is one piece of advice that got you started or helped you along your real estate investing journey?
Helped me start. I did it by accident. So I wasn't really convinced to do it. It was just like, I needed a place to live. So don't be afraid to, I think that if you're comfortable and consistently comfortable, you should be uncomfortable. And go out into that. If you're going into the zone of discomfort, then you're growing. So do that.
Yeah, I like it. What is your favorite real estate or business book that you're into right now?
I'd say Extreme Ownership by Jock Willink. I'm a leader, not only in my company, but also in the local RIA that I run, the Real Estate Investors Association. And I think that leadership and sales are two of the most important and elusive skills that are out there. So that was definitely a heavily impactful book in my life.
Awesome. I haven't heard that one, so I will have to check that out. All right. So last question is, if you hit your financial freedom number, which it sounds like you may have already, meaning you could live an amazing life just off of the passive income from your real estate investing, what would you do?
I'm really there. But I think that also there's these things that growing up with an inferiority complex, growing up where I was, I think that kids and your family just want you to be present. That's it. We took our daughter to Disney World 2 times this year, and she never got more joy than we were walking in down the street in our neighborhood and we got ice cream and she found a hopscotch place and she started hopping around. And like, we don't really need that much. We like to challenge ourselves in terms of living up to some sort of expectation that's really right. Not built for us. So I just think that my goal is just to be continually present as a husband and a father.
Awesome. I like it. I like it a lot. So Matt, how can people find you, hear you, reach out if they're interested in learning more about the Rochester market? Maybe people are like, hey, that could be a good investing spot. And obviously you've got a lot of inroads in that area. So how can people reach out to you and find you?
Yeah, I'm all the social platforms, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, even TikTok. So I'm most active on Facebook though. I just find like how the groups work in Facebook. So definitely reach out to me if you're looking, wanting to learn more about Rochester or just real estate investing in general. And I can get connected with Facebook group or whatever. I also run the Go Big Live Real Estate Investors podcast, where I interview guests just like you, Justin, on how you did your first big deal and really break it down into the granular level. If you're a details person and want to know exactly how they did that, then that's definitely a good listen as well if you want to learn about how to scale.
Awesome. No, highly recommend checking that podcast out for sure. Matt, really appreciate the time. It's been great to learn more about your story and everything. And yeah, really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it too.
I hope you got value out of this episode of the Work Hard, Invest Harder podcast, your one-stop shop for education on how you can continue to work hard in your career and have different options to invest even harder. If you took anything away from this episode, please like and comment. I read every comment as it helps me serve you better. Make sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell. That way you won't miss out on more valuable content. If you're watching this video, it means that you want to grow your passive real estate portfolio. The easiest way to do that is to join our investor club by heading to greatventurecapital.com/invest. The link is in the show notes. See you on the next episode.